chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it, come in no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may dab in the middle of it. Grass may dab in the middle. We are grass may dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness, we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off with Tucker Carlson. First part of this week on Monday night started revealing videos of some of the insights that he had garnered from having received over 41,000 videos of the January 6th, you could say, received from McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House. And so he has some insights that few of us really had before. We had garnered certain opinions and so forth, but he showed in explicit video how and why that committee lied to us. So here we go with him.
Hey, Glenn.
How are you?
How you doing?
Good.
It couldn't be better.
Yeah.
Luckily, I'm so cut off.
This is, we were talking about it earlier today. I recognize what you're going through right now.
I know you do. You're one of like three people in the world you understand.
It is crazy. It is crazy to watch it from the outside. So, Tucker. First of all, can we just get this out of the way? Are you saying that this was a peaceful event? Or are you saying this was...
Well, of course not. Of course not. No. I'm just... I tried to be pretty... I wrote those scripts myself. So any overstatement or errors of fact are my fault. But I tried to keep it specific. We focused on a couple of individuals, three. And they're Jacob Chansley, the QAnon shaman, Brian Sicknick, the Capitol police officer who died after January 6th, and Ray Epps, the mysterious figure on camera promoting violence, who was for some reason not indicted, put on the FBI's most wanted list, then pulled off and thanked by Democrats for his service. And we assessed each of those stories on the in light of the new tape that we reviewed. And in the first case, I merely made the point that here's a guy, Jacob Chansley, a Navy veteran who's doing 4 years in prison for some species of domestic terrorism, but none of us have ever been shown what he did to deserve 4 years in prison. And now we know. And there's videotape of him being led around by Capitol Police into the Senate chamber. And at one point, they try one door. It's locked on his behalf. They're trying to get him into the Senate chamber. Then they lead him in. It's on tape. And he goes into the Senate chamber and immediately says a prayer out loud of thanksgiving for the police officers who let him in.
Okay, so wait. He is being escorted by the police, but the captain of the Capitol Police said just last night that this was to de-escalate the situation.
And I'm sure there was a lot of de-escalation going on. I'm speaking of a very specific case where this was not de-escalation. It was something else. And I can't really guess as to what it was. I merely put the video up and drew my conclusions. But, of course, viewers are welcome to draw their own. But here you have a guy who's walking alone. There are no other protesters in the frame. And there are nine armed Capitol Hill police officers around him. They do not stop him. They don't try and slow him down. They don't try to bring him to an exterior exit. They bring him, they lead him, trying different doors into the Senate chamber, at which point, as I said, he says a prayer, justly, of thanksgiving for them and their assistance. Now, I can't even guess as to what motivated them, what we're looking at here, but I know what we're not looking at, which is an act of violent terrorism. And yet, this guy's doing 4 years in jail. And I'm trying not to use profanity on your show, but, like, what the heck is that? Mm-hmm. I mean, for real, like, what is that? And don't tell me it's something that it's not. And so the main conclusion that I drew is that Chuck Schumer and the horrible Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, filthy man, and Mitt Romney and Tom Tillis and Senator Kramer of North Dakota. Like, they're all lying. They're all lying. And a lot of them are Republicans. Why are they lying about what we can see plainly? And why didn't they want us to see it? And again, I can't sort of fill in that blank. I can't answer that question. But I know deception when I see it. It's demonstrable. It's proven. And they should, I think, be asked to explain themselves. Like, it's not enough to say, oh, it was the worst violent insurrection since Gettysburg or something. Okay, fine. Stop with the overstatement, the hyperbole, and just explain to me what I'm looking on the screen and seeing, you know?
Tucker, because I've been in this situation before, let me ask you. If I came to you and I gave you some edited footage of something, and I said, no, Tucker, this is what it is. You're not going to believe this. I mean, I'm going to show you some stuff, but this was an armed insurrection. It was really bad. Let me show you, and I've edited some tape and given it to you. If that turned out that I edited out the things that you found, would you just kind of go quiet, or would you come out and blast me to smithereens?
I'd feel deceived. And,
right.
And as you know, you've worked in television most of your life. You've worked around pictures. You know their power, and you know their capacity to deceive. Nothing is more misleading than pictures. Mm-hmm. You think you're seeing the whole story. You're not. And all of us who work in this medium know that. And so I think TV people, above all, and movie people, anyone who works around pictures, is very aware of their power and their capacity for deception. And so we're suspicious. Okay, you show me those pictures, you whip me into a lather, but is there something you're not showing me? Did you edit that? And so from the very first day, I wanted to see all the video. And
right.
And I don't understand why is MSNBC and CNN and, you know, NBC News and CBS, and like, why is no one else interested?
It's beyond not interested. If they were innocent of this, if they were just saying, hey, we're just reporting what we have been told and what we were given, I would feel very deceived. And I would be the loudest in the room saying, release all of it to me, because what I just saw doesn't match what you gave me. Why aren't they standing up and defending their own honor and integrity?
Well, that's it. That's it. Oh, God. I'm so grateful you said that, because that's the core of it. It's not even thank you for saying that. It's not even about politics, partisanship, power. It's about dignity.
Yes.
It's about your own self-respect. I'm an adult man. I'm 53. I have four grown children. I pay my taxes. I'm a citizen lifelong of this country. You can't lie to me. You diminish me when you do that. And if I participate in that, if I allow you to lie to me, then I'm no longer a free man. I'm a slave. And that has to do with me. It's not even about you. I have self-respect, and I cannot allow that to continue without me saying something about it, because I respect myself. I hold myself to higher standards. I'm not Mahatma Gandhi or something. I don't want to overstate my virtue. I'm not very virtuous, actually. But I do have some standard of self-respect, and they don't. And it's shocking to me.
You called the January 6th committee members liars. Besides suggestions that, you know, Sitnik was murdered, not even suggestions, but claiming that. Do you make the case that they're liars? They didn't just, you know, fib a bit and eat around the corners. That these are full-fledged liars.
Well, that was the stunning part to me. I've been in Washington my whole life, and my dad worked for the government, so I had a kind of root-level trust in government, or a trust in government, but, like, the whole thing can't be fraudulent, because I know the people who work there. My dad was one of them. Like, this is, you know, I'm very much from that world. I guess that's what I'm saying. So my default setting is not they're lying about everything. I never assumed that. And so I was shocked to learn that they were lying intentionally. And the way that we know that, we have a very specific way of knowing that, which is, when January 6th committee researchers looked at video, they bookmarked it. They left an electronic mark on the video they watched. So we know what they watched, and then we watched it. And so there is video of Chansley, of Ray Epps, and of Brian Sicknick that we know they watched, that was not included in the report, was never mentioned in the hearings, a year and a half, 1,000 witnesses, 850-page report. And this video, which overturns the story they were telling, proves it was a lie, they saw but hid. So, you know, I'm always hesitant to go to motive because who understands people's motives? You know, you can only really guess about them. But in this specific case, we know that they lied. And that just blew my mind. I mean, you know, some of these guys, if Adam Schiff lies, I think Adam Schiff, there are spiritual forces surrounding Adam Schiff. Like, I think he is a force of darkness, and I mean that. But somebody, is Benny Thompson evil? Like, I have trouble believing, you know, like, is, I mean, I've known Liz Cheney for 25 years. Is Liz Cheney, like, actually a liar? I just always assume she just disagrees on the issues with me. No, it turns out Liz Cheney is actually affirmatively a liar. She knew information, she withheld it because it challenged the lie that she was telling to the public. And that just completely, I mean, call me naive, I guess I'm sure everyone listening is like, how stupid are you? Well, I guess kind of stupid because I was blown away by that.
So I know you don't want to go into motivation, but this is a pretty large lie. I don't want to use big lie because that's what Schumer used and Hitler used. but it's a pretty large lie. What is the motivation?
Well, if you know, again, I can only speculate, but I know the effects of the lie, and they're not small. This is an event that was a complex event with many facets, and they simplified it immediately into a good versus evil tale, as they do with everything, partly because they lack nuance and imagination and sophistication, but partly because this was a tool they were using for a purpose. It was a cudgel they were using to beat down their opponents and grab more power for themselves. And in effect, what it did was change the definition of terrorism from something that, you know, exists in other countries and is aimed at us to Republican voters, populist voters. I shouldn't say Republican because Bernie Sanders voters, Trump voters, anybody who questions the legitimacy of the current
two-party system,
power holders, is now redefined not as a political opponent but as a terrorist. And that has very specific consequences. It means all of a sudden you can harness the world's largest law enforcement organization, the FBI, and the intel agencies, CIA, NSA, Defense Intelligence, all of them. And you can harness them against your political opponents. And that's exactly what they did, not just in the hundreds of people who went to jail and the almost 100 who were still in jail without trial as political prisoners 26 months later, but all the other people who are just political activists who have views, people, honestly, people like you, like they can read your text messages. They did read mine. NSA read my text messages and then threatened me with them. And, you know, I brought this to members of Congress. They had a hearing on it. NSA admitted they did it. And then nothing happened. You know, that director of the NSA is still in office, like nothing happens. And you realize, wow, the largest organization in human history, the federal government, has been harnessed as a political tool. It's like the one thing you can't allow. And we have allowed it. It's happened with the complicity of Republicans, certainly with Mitch McConnell's complicity. And that's just mind blowing. And then it's like, well, what do I do now? You know, I'm not going to leave America. I'm from here. I love this country. I have four kids. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay here. But you really start to feel like I've always thought I was a very patriotic person, fly the American flag, believe in the country. And all of a sudden, it's like the power centers in the country, the government, which is supposed to be nonpartisan, serving all of us equally as citizens, that's turned against me like I'm some Al-Qaeda member from Baluchistan or something. Like, what? It's very bewildering. I will say that.
Yeah, I think part of it is because we forgot what Washington said, which was, you know, government is like fire. You control it, it's fine. If it controls you, it'll burn everything down. And we confused our love of the principles of our country with the love of and trust of our government. Trust the principles.
Yes.
Not the government. Back with Tucker Carlson here in 60 seconds. So, Tucker, what is it that... What if you know, cause I think you're making points that I understand, but the left intentionally is misunderstanding them and trying to direct the conversation into places that you're not suggesting. What is the message that you want people to walk away with this week? What's the point of what you're doing?
That you're being lied to and that you deserve better. Your government's not allowed to lie to you. That's against the law. They're not allowed to lie to you. It's your government. and you should demand better. And I would say in a very specific way, I've alluded to it a couple of times, that for people who are not, you know, supporters of President Biden, who think the system needs reform, that it doesn't represent them, it doesn't serve their interests, those people are Republican voters because they have no option. They vote for the Republican Party. There's no third party, a meaningful one. And so very specifically, they have to demand more from their own representatives or else democracy isn't real. So representative democracy, that means your will is expressed through the votes of the people you vote for to go to Washington on your behalf. And that is absolutely not happening. Their priorities are in a different universe from the priorities of their voters. You don't see that on the left. Democratic politicians make some effort to represent their own voters. Republican politicians do not. Mitch McConnell has zero interest in what you think about anything. And that is that's a structural problem with the party. And I don't know what the fix is. I think part of the problem is that Republican voters don't like – the donors don't like Republican voters. They clearly don't, you know, and the biggest donors to the Republican Party think Republican voters are disgusting. And that's a huge, huge problem. That's not true on the other side. So I don't know, but I – you know, there's kind of nothing you can do about Merrick Garland if you're your average voter. But if you're a member of Congress is like not even bothering to listen to what you care about, you have a way to replace him. It's called a primary. And I don't know why that never happens. I mean, I really don't understand. I mean, Adam Kinzinger would still be serving in the Congress if he wasn't redistricted out of his seat. And like, what is that? You know, were the majority of Republican voters in his Illinois district on his side? No, but he would have gotten reelected. So there's a problem with our system. And I hope that can be fixed.
We experienced just recently a major bank, the Silicon Valley Bank in California, go under and fail and be seized by the regulators. And just recently, Mary Bartiromo had an in-depth interview with Larry McDonald, and he's saying that we're in for an imminent crash in the stock market. Here we go with Maria Bartiromo and Larry McDonald.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell back on Capitol Hill today for day two of his testimony. He will be in front of the House Financial Services Committee this morning. Stocks tumbled yesterday after his comments that rates may have to go higher to rein in inflation. Watch this.
The latest economic data have come in stronger than expected. If the totality of the data were to indicate that faster tightening is warranted, we'd be prepared to increase the pace of rate hikes.
Joining me now is the Bear Traps Report founder and New York Times bestselling author, Larry McDonald. Larry, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for being here. I want to get your take on Jay Powell yesterday. What did you make of the speech?
Well, it's kind of like it's overcooking the goose. You know, they're playing catch up. And while they were doing quantitative easing in 2021, inflation started to rage. And now they're trying to catch up. Our 21 Lehman systemic risk indicators that look at equity and credit point to one of the highest probabilities of a crash in the stock market looking out 60 days.
Wow, 60 days? You're saying you're going to see it? We're going to see a crash in the stock market within 60 days?
Yes, because the withdrawal of capital from the middle class families is so spectacular. For every 1%. Increase. Now, a lot of these economists and Wall Street people, they throw around, oh, the Fed's hiking basis, you know, 100 basis points, 50 basis points. The bottom line is for every 1% increase in rates, and we've done almost 5% now, every 1% takes $50 billion out of the pockets of middle-class families. Auto loans right now are approaching 14%. Almost 20% of auto loans are $1,000 a month. And so the middle-class families are getting hammered here, and so the consumer pressure is, you know, violent. But on the high end, you know, the wealthy are doing well with excess savings and higher interest rates.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm glad you brought up rates because we're talking about the 2-year above 5% today. Mortgage rates just out moments ago, the 30-year fixed rate up again now to 6.79% last week. I mean, Larry, the last time we saw mortgage rates shoot up this way, we saw real demand destruction. People were walking away from their mortgages. A new Fannie Mae survey finds Americans are pessimistic about their personal financial outlook. 31% of Americans said that they expect their their personal finances to improve over the next year. But that's the lowest reading since 2010. Larry, before you get into what we're looking at in terms of rates and the impact, I want to bring Adam Johnson in here because he's on the other side of this trade. Adam, you're not expecting a recession.
No, I'm not expecting a recession. And my argument is the two E's of earnings and employment. Employment's at an all-time high, and earnings, while not stunning, are better than feared, and revenues are actually rising 5%. Larry, I'm curious, you made the comment that there's some sort of pending crash coming up in 60 days. I mean, that's a pretty bold statement.
I mean, that's what he's getting from his Lehman indicators. He talks to so many institutions every day. Go ahead.
But I mean, 60 days, Larry, I mean, do you really believe that your indicators are right and that there's some sort of crash when you have the most amount of people ever making the most amount of money ever, spending the most amount of money ever, and it's translating into earnings that, while not stellar, are enabling revenues to actually rise?
Go ahead, Larry.
Well, remember, if you have $10 million in the stock market 2 years ago, you're flat. Okay? So there's a lot of people that have had money in the market for a long time, all these failed rallies. That's beating on the psychology of investors, number one. Number two, $10 million in cash today generates $510,000 a year in treasuries, in one-year treasuries.
Wow.
Okay? Think about that. A year ago, you're talking, this was $70,000. We have to do the math here, okay? Common sense. So you're even in the market. You've been in the market for 2 years in these moronic FANG stocks that have gone nowhere, right? The most crowded trade on earth. You're flat to down after 2 years. And now you're looking over at a money market fund or a one-year treasury, and you get $510,000 of interest risk-free when a year ago you were getting 70.
All right. In other words, what you're saying, Larry, if I'm hearing you right, and I'll let you run with this, is that effectively the average investor is smart enough to recognize there's now a choice between stocks and bonds. So that average investor is going to say, I'm going to sell my stocks and I'm going to go buy bonds and just make 5%. Is that basically where you're getting the notion?
Yeah, that's exactly what he's saying. There's real competition now to stocks. If I'm going to make $500,000 in fixed income, what the hell am I, dithering around in the stock market if, in fact, I'm worried about a profits recession? Is that right, Larry?
Maria, let me ask you a question. Maria, Elaine Gazzarelli in the 80s, right? And you were probably too young for this, right?
I remember Elaine Gazzarelli. She was a real long-time bull.
Well, she was a long-time bull, but you know what flipped her is her model. She had this risk-free model versus equities, and it made her so famous because in the summer of 2007, the risk-free rate went up so much, she flipped to bearish because of that risk-free rate threat to equities. I'm seeing a similar dynamic now. An incredible stat is twos, tens are 100 basis points inverted. So that means the two-year treasury is 100 basis points more than tens. That's threatening. But then on top of that, you look at the underperformance of the regional banks. So your regional banks are your classic canary in the coal mine. They're underperforming the S&P by like 6, 7, 8% over the last 6, 9 months a year. So the regional banks are telling you something really bad is happening under the surface in commercial real estate, auto loans, residential. There's really massive cracks under the surface, and that's why the market probably goes down 10, 20%, maybe 30% the next 60 days.
10, 20, 30% in the next 60 days. What do you do and what do you say about the jobs picture? We've got the February jobs report out on Friday. We're waiting on ADP. It's going to be out in 30 minutes' time. We'll see what the ADP numbers show in 30 minutes. But for the jobs number, we're expecting 203,000 jobs added to the economy, Larry. We're expecting the unemployment rate to hold steady at 3.4%. The ADP report, which is out in 30 minutes, is also expecting job growth of 200,000 private sector jobs. So how do you have a recession? How do you have a stock market sell-off, a crash, when we get this kind of job growth?
Well, if you look back at 2000, right, the biggest number in jobs right before the 2000 drawdown, 2001, the strongest number the previous like year and a half was literally right before the market buckled. And one of the weird things is, and Adam's alluding to this, and I can see what Adam's making a good point, jobs are strong. But if you look at, when I talk to behind me, we run an institutional chat with about 650 investors around the world. And one of the things they're talking about is when you have this January number that was so spectacular,
yeah,
it's gotten a lot of people excited about a soft landing. But if you look back the last 20, 30 years, when you have this seasonal adjustment in January, typically the February, when you have that spectacular kind of outperformance, which is seasonal, typically there's like a mean reversion in February and March. And that's why you probably get like some nice move down in jobs, which will give the, which actually help the Fed a little bit. If we unemployment goes up, it'll give the Fed a little breathing room,
yeah.
Right? So that may in some ways help. But in that case, you want to be long gold miners and things that will benefit emerging market equities, things that will benefit from the Fed cutting rates.
Well, I will say Stephanie Pomboy has been calling for this for a while. But real quick, Larry, based on all of your research and your conversations with all those institutions, where do you hide away from gold? Is that it? I mean, gold is a hedge. You say buy the gold miners in the stock market. Are there any other areas to hide within the stock market if, in fact, these predictions are right that we're going to see a stock market crash within 60 days?
Okay, one of the things we're looking at is from 2001 to 2003, 2004, I was on the Lehman trading floor in that period. And when you went around the trading floor after the dot-com crash, the most popular investment was European global equities. And if you look at a chart, Adam can pull this up for you later, but if you look at a chart of the global equities ex-U.S., okay, global equities ex-United States, versus the NASDAQ or versus the S&P, you're breaking a multi-year down channel. You're talking about 10, 15 years of massive outperformance from the United States. Now, for the first time, you're seeing spectacular outperformance from global equities, MSCI ex-US, which we would say. That is where the outperformance is going to be.
Well, I mean, look, okay. What you're saying is that U.S. stocks sell off and Europe doesn't. I have a hard time believing that in fact, if the U.S. sells off, we get a stock market crash, the rest of the world doesn't follow. And that MSCI index is loaded with Chinese stocks. So there's that issue as well, the China threat.
Yes. The EWU, well, first of all, you're 100% right. In the initial drawdown, the European equities will underperform with the U.S., but they'll outperform the U.S. over the next 2 years.
Okay.
The EWU portfolio is a golden portfolio of value global equities, EW. It's referenced as the United Kingdom, but it's a Hall of Fame basket of, like, global value equities.
Yeah.
That's, I think, that hard asset basket, that's the basket that's going to outperform what we call financial assets in the United States, so
okay.
Growth stocks.
All right, Larry, we'll be watching. Is there a trigger for this stock market crash? Is it more inflation data? Is it more economic data that misses estimates?
The trigger will be, like, the S&P earnings, everybody's expecting, the street is expecting $226.
Yeah.
That's priced for perfection. So what happens is when we deteriorate in jobs the next 2-3 months, that will bring into question the S&P earnings,
okay.
And the S&P earnings are probably 190, so that'll trigger it.
And that's the Stephanie Pomboy narrative. That's what she's been saying on this program now. It's going to be a profits recession. Well, I guess that's what makes a market, Larry. If you're selling, it looks like Adam's going to be buying.
I am buying.
Okay. That's what makes a market. Larry McDonald, it's great to see you, sir. Thank you so much.
John Carney is saying we may experience additional bank failures. And so this is a recent interview just this week with John Carney, what he had to say about any future of bank failures.
Well, all right, tough stuff. Will the collapse of this Silicon Valley bank, is this going to cause a financial meltdown? Bank stocks getting hammered. The whole stock market's getting hammered. It's not the only thing going on, but it's a big thing. Joining us, John Carney, Breitbart Economics and Finance Editor, co-author of the Breitbart Business Digest. John, welcome back as always. You just told me, I didn't know this, the FDIC has seized the bank, presumably thrown out all the officers in connection with the California banking authorities. Can you tell us more about this?
That's right. So they've been officially put into receivership. They say that all of the insured depositors will get their deposits back. But that's not really very reassuring because a large percentage of the deposits at this bank are not insured. They're above the insurance level. Mm-hmm. And so if you are a business and you had a lot of money in this bank, you now do not know. I mean, look, the odds are I bet people will be able to get almost all of their deposits out. I don't think the FDIC is looking to inflict harm on depositors, and that would also cause a, further panic about other banks next week. But this bank had something like 90% of its deposits are uninsured. So there are people who are at risk of losing their deposits, at least on paper.
So SVB, biggest lender to the Silicon Valley companies, the techies have had a very bad run in the last year, maybe 2 years. But you're saying there's also, not to be too detailed, but it's important, that there's a mismatch between the cost of their liabilities and the return on their assets.
Sure. One of the problems was when money was so freely available to all these startups, they didn't borrow a lot. So they had a ton of deposits coming in and not a lot of opportunity to make loans out to people. I mean, yeah, you can lend money so people can buy a yacht or, you know, a fancy mortgage on a, you know, on some tech startup billionaire's, you know, fancy mansion. But they really had way too much money, so they invested it in bonds. And in Bank of America, I think, has 25% of its assets are in bonds. But this bank had over 50% of its assets in bonds.
And now the curve is inverted.
Right. And so they're losing money.
So the cost of money and the repo rate and the Fed funds rate is, it's heading for 5. We'll call it 5%. It's 4.75. And the 10-year is back under 4. Oh, yeah, so there's a negative return. They're inverting.
Right. They're losing money. And at the same time, all these startups who are depositing so much money there are now withdrawing it in order to make – because they don't have access to free money anymore. Mm-hmm. So they're withdrawing it just to pay their bills. So you're having the deposits go down. They have to sell into a market where they are actually producing real losses, not just mark-to-market losses.
Yep.
And that is what sparked the panic, basically. People said, look – earlier this week, they announced something like a $2 billion loss on their assets. Mm-hmm. And people said, I better get my money out quickly, especially because these businesses, if you're a business and you have a deposit with Silicon Valley Bank, you don't want to risk not being able to get that on Monday morning. Sure. So you pulled it out today.
Yeah, the FDIC stepped in to avoid an old-fashioned run on the bank.
Absolutely.
Now, what's the risk that this spreads?
I think there's a high risk that it spreads. These things do not end when, you know, people are right now looking at every other bank that, you know, not the big banks, the J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo's, they'll be fine.
Which are pretty well capitalized.
Yes, they're extremely well capitalized.
But the regionals?
The banking system is extremely well capitalized. And so I don't think we're on the verge of a financial crisis, but I do think we'll probably have a couple more bank failures ahead of us.
East Coast, West Coast, any sense of that? Real estate related or just technology related?
Yeah, well, so commercial real estate is in a lot of trouble. I mean, you think about all these loans into office buildings that now are not paying their rent because they're half full. So I think that there is going to be losses. I think we're going to see a lot of the California-based financial institutions get into trouble because they were so dependent on this, you know, very cheap money ecosystem that was feeding startup culture and is no longer there.
What happens to the startup culture now? There's no cheap money, no cheap money, maybe historically cheap, but doesn't matter. They're going to have trouble getting loans. Eh?
Absolutely. They have trouble getting loans and have trouble raising money because if you can get 5% on a treasury bond, mm-hmm. why are you trying to get 10% on a, you know, very risky startup? You're not going to do that. You might as well just double down on leverage and get a treasury. So I think that they're going to have a lot of trouble being able to continue to raise money. And we're going to see a lot of the startups, you know, start to tilt over.
Tilt over. Layoffs are going to come. Yeah. So it's not the biggest part of the economy in terms of manpower. It's capital intensive. But still, it's a big problem. And you are worried that it's going to spread.
I do think it's going to spread because, look, this bank, Silicon Valley Bank, was very well respected. It was not.
No, it was the hottest bank.
Right.
Everybody. Hottest bank.
Right. And so if you can tip them over this quickly in just a matter of days, I think people are going to start to look and say, uh-oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't have my money in. I don't want to name the names of the other banks because I don't want to start the panic. But, you know, maybe I should put it into Wells Fargo instead.
Mm-hmm.
And any bank in a fractional reserve system can be tipped over if the depositors start to panic.
We'll talk some more about this on the radio tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you got it. John Carney of Breitbart. Great stuff.
An in-depth, really insightful by Stephanie Pomboy is next. And she has become an expert at calling some of these turndowns and these bust out of the market and the banks also. So here we go with Stephanie Pomboy.
Bring in Macro Mavens founder, Stephanie Pomboy. Stephanie, it's not the first. It won't be the last. Why will this be even worse than 2007, 2008?
Well, I think it's interesting that everyone's characterizing this as stunning in terms of the speed with which this bank collapsed. I think, frankly, the surprise has been that it has taken this long for something to break. I mean, we have undergone the fastest, most aggressive Fed rate hikes in history, far more aggressive than Volcker and certainly far more aggressive than anything we saw that led up to the global financial crisis in 2007-08. And the reality is they're doing it all against a backdrop of an incredibly leveraged economy and a financial system outside the regulatory purview, this part that's outside the regulatory purview of the Federal Reserve, that's been really run kind of like the Wild West. And now we're discovering just how much so. So I do think this is the tip of the iceberg. I think we'll see a lot more stories like this. And then I do think that the problems will bleed out, as they invariably do, to other parts of the market. And I'm thinking specifically, Dagan, about the corporate bond market. You know, a lot of the VC companies that were involved with this bank have been buying up these zombie companies and lathering up debt on them and trying to spin them out. Those zombie companies have over $1 trillion in debt that's going to evaporate, and a lot of people are going to be left holding the bag when that happens. So this is just the beginning of the story as far as I'm concerned.
So, Stephanie, we had a stronger than expected job numbers today, over 300,000. And so that will lead us to believe that the Fed is going to keep raising rates. But if they keep raising rates, I imagine that's going to mean more pressure on more banks. So do you see maybe a pause because of the pressure on the banks from the Fed?
Well, I guess the question is the banks that the Fed has been regulating are probably going to be fine. I mean, I guess there'll be some reverberations in terms of confidence. And frankly, the banks are being very greedy because you can get 5% on a 12-month T-bill, and yet they're holding deposit rates below 1%. So they're going to have to raise those rates if they want to keep their deposits, because, you know, deposits are now declining at the fastest rate in several decades. So this is a story that they can address, and they can, you know, fix that problem. But I think that, yeah, as relates to the Federal Reserve, so they're not going to be concerned about sort of a 2008-style meltdown in the banking sector per se. But the blowback to the broader economy here will be meaningful. And I guess it depends on how quickly that becomes evident. And frankly, this morning's payroll report is just more of the same in terms of keeping the Fed's feet to the fire. And we got some relief on the wage front. And you are seeing, you know, internally things like part-time jobs are where the growth is and full-time jobs are slowing dramatically. That's typically been a recession signal. So we'll start to get some traction on these numbers. But, you know, the Fed has talked up and insisted it's going to hold rates higher for longer so often here that I think they'd look pretty ridiculous to pivot immediately and rush to bail out any of these players who were, frankly, irresponsible.
Stephanie, it's just reading your notes. It is absolutely insane, though, that regulators in Washington and even the Federal Reserve wouldn't know that this was at least a possibility, given the fact that last year was this horrific bear market in treasuries because of what the Fed was doing with rapidly raising interest rates, and the anniversary is coming up next week of the first rate increase, but also the stringent changes in capital requirements where the banks were forced to hold treasuries. So essentially, when money starts going out of the door in deposits, there's these banks like SVP are sitting on losses. And so when you have to start realizing those losses, boom, you need to raise capital. It's very simple. But I want you to listen to Jenny Yellen. She was the Treasury Secretary. And she's saying, oh no, don't worry. This is isolated. Listen to this.
I will just say you mentioned Silicon Valley Bank. There are recent developments that concern a few banks that I'm monitoring very carefully. And when banks experience financial losses, it is and should be a matter of concern.
Help us.
I was just laughing because if that is not the most unconfidence-inspiring commentary, I don't know what is. I mean, it's terrifying. But as you said, Dagan, this is all totally predictable. When you force the banks to hold nothing but treasuries and agencies and you ratchet up interest rates at the fastest pace in history and drive sharp losses in those same quote-unquote risk-free assets, you're going to create some dislocations. And I think probably what happened is that the fact that nothing untoward had occurred over the last 12 months imbued their confidence that, hey, actually, maybe everything's going to be just fine. So they continue to talk tough and keep raising rates. Meanwhile, I keep trying to describe this not as a tightening cycle, but as an interest rate shock. And the full force of that is going to make itself known in a hurry. And I think we're now starting to see that unfold before us. And that should really accelerate big time. As you mentioned, we're at the 1 year anniversary and a lot of stuff happens, you know, in terms of debt that matures, et cetera. And now we're going to have to roll debt at much higher rates and we'll see how that goes over.
Stephanie, great to see you. More time. Always. I want more time with my palm boy.
So smart.
Thank you so much.
What also broke this week is this scandal about Fossey and, his lying before Congress several times. Rand Paul called him outright. Then he called, Fossey had the audacity to call Rand Paul a liar. Anyway, Laura Ingraham had a really good interview and tied a lot of loose ends together about the outstanding scandal concerning Fauci and what has been going on with the Wuhan lab.
All right, I am Laura Ingraham. This is the Ingraham Angle from Washington tonight, and we begin the hour with a scandal of monumental significance. Finally, with Republicans in charge of the House, the rocks are being lifted on the COVID cover-up. And the rot that we see underneath is what we warned you about long ago. Rank corruption at the heart of our federal response. Now, the former CDC director under Trump, Dr. Robert Redfield, was questioned about Anthony Fauci's mad scramble to conceal the role he and others played with greenlighting the funding to the Wuhan lab in China. So what did Redfield think of the paper that Fauci pressured scientists to write back in February 2020 that would conclude ultimately that COVID most likely did not escape from a lab?
This whole approach that was taken, it's antithetical to science.
Thank you.
Science has debate, and they squashed any debate.
Do you think that the paper does hide the truth?
I think it's an inaccurate paper that basically was part of a narrative that they were creating. Remember, this pandemic did not start in January at the seafood market. We now know there was infections all the way back into September. This was a narrative that was decided that they were going to say this came from the wet market and they were going to do everything they could to support it to negate any discussion about the possibility that this came from a lab.
But wait a second. Anthony Fauci insisted under oath that the gain-of-function research, the riskiest research you can do on a virus, wasn't being done at the Wuhan lab with our help.
Dr. Fauci was affirmatively told in an email that NIAID had a monetary relationship with the Wuhan Institute through EcoHealth Alliance. He was told this in January 27th of 2020. Do you think that Dr. Fauci intentionally lied under oath to Senator Paul when he vehemently denied NIH's funding of gain-of-function research?
I think there's no doubt that NIH was funding gain-of-function research.
Is it likely that American tax dollars funded the gain-of-function research that created this virus?
I think it did, not only from NIH, but from the State Department, USAID, and from DOD.
Okay, do you realize what this all means? Well, not surprisingly, Redfield told the committee that he found himself shut out of key calls early on in the pandemic. And that was when Fauci and company realized that Redfield was not going to toe the party line.
Why do you think you were excluded from those calls?
Because it was told to me that they wanted a single narrative and that I obviously had a different point of view.
All about the science. Well, these sanctimonious camera hounds who flanked Trump
Day after day in the White House briefing room, these people who were pushing for these damaging lockdowns and smearing good doctors and researchers who knew the truth about inexpensive antiviral treatments, they did more than grandstand on camera, though, these people. Those people destroyed public trust in our public health officials and our entire public health system. So why weren't Fauci, his boss Francis Collins, and their useful idiot Deborah Birx at all interested in discussing what renowned experts were saying about when and how COVID spread? What explains their stunning lack of curiosity?
In September of 2019, three things happened in that lab. One is they deleted the sequences. It was highly irregular. Second thing they did was they changed the command and control of the lab from the civilian control to the military control. Highly unusual. And the third things they did, which I think is really telling, is they let a contractor redo the ventilation system in that laboratory.
There must be accountability here. There must be full transparency on the money we funneled to Wuhan. Yeah, all courtesy of you, the U.S. taxpayers. If our own public health officials had a direct or indirect involvement in the research that led to this global pandemic, Merrick Garland, our attorney general, the entire DOJ should be ready to impanel a grand jury. There should be indictments. Oh, no. But remember, he thinks the biggest threat facing the American people are guys like that so-called QAnon shaman they threw in jail. He's the big threat. The big money in medical research from pharma and from the federal government, it has corrupted huge swaths of our scientific community, and it must stop.
The scientific community is very afraid to speak up on political issues. And I think the reason is that the government grants are handed out through this system of peer review committees. Right. And so you don't want any single scientist on your peer review committee to vote against you. This means that they cannot be relied upon in the way that I think we would like them to be independent and forthright and call it as they see it.
For revealing how the sausage is made, by the way, that was the former medical editor of the New York Times, for how the whole scientific hierarchy cares more about their grants than the health of the American people, Nicholas Wade, you just saw there, was attacked by committee Democrats.
Inviting someone with discredited and dangerous views like Mr. Wade's to testify on the origins of this pandemic, which has disproportionately harmed communities of color, is not responsible or credible oversight.
For a race of people who have suffered, endured, and survived three centuries of slavery, oppression, deprivation, degradation, I'm absolutely offended that you would have the opportunity to take this platform and to add anything of significance to it.
But Mr. Wade left out another motivating factor. Well, these figures are smearing him, of course. This is just a textbook, as we've talked about so much on the Ingram angle. More than just the relationship with China that Fauci, et cetera, were protecting, as we found out back in February 2020, what was of utmost importance to Fauci, watch.
I think early on in the outbreak, it was clear that there was some muddling of information, but over the last several weeks, the Chinese authorities have really been very explicit that they were going to not tolerate any misinformation going out.
I'm surprised that you would say that, given what we know pattern of lying about critical issues, Dr. Fauci.
The Chinese scientists I've dealt with myself personally for years, if not decades. I have faith that they are not distorting things.
So China will not let any misinformation go out. He's reassuring the American public on China's behalf in that interview I did with him in February 2020. The money, the power, the fame, the media's complicity with all of this, and the dangerous and lucrative obsession that so many had in the medical community with this gain-of-function research, that was all more important to all of these people, including Fauci, than coming clean about important facts at every stage of a global pandemic.
We're going to end the last 9 minutes of this with Jay Dyer. And what he'd gotten into, he gets into really interesting things. There was a fish, a Rokoski, during the Trotskyite trials, and they interrogated Rokoski, and he revealed really the global crime syndicate that was behind communism and who was really behind it. And it was really, really interesting. His name was Christian G. Rokoski, and I'll put up an article so you'll be able to read that and follow it along. But here we go. We're just going to end all the way to our exit music with Jay Dyer, and then I'll put up a embedded clip where you can hear the full interview. It's a pronounced interview this Friday. But here we go with Jay Dyer.
Welcome to the fourth hour. This is your guest host, Jay Dyer, Jay's Analysis. Thank you. I wanted to talk about dialectics and understanding and the manipulation of dialectics. You know, we saw today or yesterday in the recent release of the newest batch of the Twitter files that there's this collusion between NGOs, between private self-appointed authorities, between intelligence agencies, so-called, that are there to really shut down any critique, any dissension. And we knew that this was going on for a long time, but now it's completely vindicated with these Twitter files. And I think that the key here is to understand that this control system isn't new, and it's something that has existed for a long time. And there's certain ways that the control system works that are so crucial to understand that we often forget, and that is controlled opposition and controlled dialectics. Controlled dialectics is itself an older Marxist idea that actually goes back to ancient Greece and ancient pagan religions. So you've heard me probably talk about Plato's Republic, right? Plato's Republic is about this idea of setting up the perfect utopian city-state. Now, I don't think in Plato's mind he thought he could really set up a utopian city-state, but he thought that you could try to shoot for that with a form of a mix of kind of authoritarianism with the philosopher king at the top, a degree of kind of communitarianism or communism in the middle, and then a large working base at the bottom of the pyramid. And so there's a famous document from the Cold War that harkens back to this, believe it or not, that is kind of forgotten. And it's a document that deals with an interrogation of a Trotskyite Marxist under the Stalinist regime, under the NKVD. So two branches of Marxism that are kind of battling amongst themselves. And there was a guy named Christian Rokoski, who was a Bulgarian a socialist, who was then eventually brought into the high levels of the Communist International to be a spokesperson, so to speak, at different levels and as an ambassador to other countries and whatnot. And he got arrested at one point, and he's part of the trial of the 20, right? There's these 20 figures underneath the Stalin regime, where Stalin purged a bunch of the Trotskyites. And if you don't know, there was these internal battles and struggles within the history of Marxism, communism, socialism for who would be really the face of communism, Marxism, who would run this system, who would be the power. Would it be the so-called pure classical Marxists, the true Marxists, or would it be this new kind of Stalinism, which was very centralized in the sense of like a dictator and all that? And Stalin realized that the policies of the Bolsheviks, for example, were pretty disastrous. Now, Stalin, I think, was a tyrant and a monster. He was a terrible person. But he realized that these really wild policies of the Bolsheviks that we kind of see in today's Antifa-style stuff, that it was totally destructive, that it wouldn't work. So he tried to scale back some of that and have just a total dictatorship. And so as a result of this, there was a lot of former Marxists who were mad at him, right? There's a lot of Trotskyites. There's a lot of Leninists and so forth, Mensheviks, Bolsheviks, that were mad at Stalin, so they kind of went to war, and then Stalin purged them, and there's a wild testimony from one of those guys that he interrogated. Don't go anywhere, this is the Alex Jones Show, I'm your host, Jay Dyer. Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. We're talking about the interrogation of the agent of Trotsky, the figure of Rokoski, who was interrogated under the NKVD, under Stalin. And it's a kind of a speculative text. We don't know 100% if this is totally accurate because, of course, it comes out of the period of the Stalinist regime. But it is one piece of evidence that actually supports the thesis of both Quigley and Professor Anthony Sutton that we've covered for so many years over here. So the thesis deals with whether or not Marxism, socialism is a real organic movement or whether it's kind of something propped up from the outside. And the reason that I'm talking about this is that when we understand the dialectics of the Cold War, that Manichaean pitting of East against the West, which was engineered at a higher level by very powerful Western industrialists, corporatists, and banking interests, then we can begin to understand how the system that we live in today is a circle in which we're in a controlled back and forth, kind of like a pong match, ping pong, right? And you're only allowed to discuss topics within this predefined circle. And there's also a text that's pretty well known that's very closely related to this idea, which is the book Fire in the Minds of Men by James Billington. And in Fire in the Minds of Men, it's a treatise on the history of French revolutionary Marxist socialist ideas. And he was not a conspiracy guy. He was the Librarian of Congress. So he was actually a scholar, and he was a big supporter, a big fan of this idea of the history of revolutionary thought from the French Revolution up till today. And sort of how it culminated up into the Bolshevik Revolution. So he begins his book, The French Revolution, then he ends it with the Russian Bolshevik Revolution and then into the Stalinist period. So revolution in this system is based on the idea of dialectics, the idea that everything in life is a black and white, yes, no, yin-yang, push-pull situation. And it's fundamental also to Darwinism that the survival of the fittest, that this power struggle is something that is fundamental and inherent to the existing order. And that's itself what propels progress in this order. That's how we get to the higher stages. And so it's called, in this situation, for example, esoteric Marxism, right? In the interrogation, we have this discussion going on where the figure of Rakovsky is being interrogated by the NKVD, and he says, you guys don't really understand Marxism. Marxism is much more than a economic system. It's a lot more than some kind of theory about modes of production and who owns the means and modes of production. He says it's not primarily a social justice phenomenon. This verbiage and this idea might have been used or attached to Marxism over the years, but that's not primarily what it's about. He says, and you guys have corrupted true Marxism, you Stalinists. And he says that we will have the ultimate victory because we know the long game plan. And this really takes the interrogator, the guy named Gabriel, for a bit of a surprise. He says, what do you mean you're going to win in the long run? He says, well, because I know who's really running this. He says, who's really running it? What do you mean? He says, well, you have to understand what Marxism is, what socialism ultimately is. He says, it is not about fixing economic systems and injustices. He says, ultimately, it's a kind of religion. Now, he says, it's not a religion in the sense of we believe in, supernatural powers. But he says it's a religion that's at a commitment to a single idea, which is revolutionary dialectic, which is the end goal. So there's not necessarily a utopia at the end, right? Marx talked about the possibility that there could be a utopia or something like that and the withering away of the state. But he says there's not really any guiding necessary principle that we will necessarily get to a utopia. It might end in a collapse. It might end in chaos. Who knows? But he says that our commitment is to revolution. And he says everything else serves revolution. That's it. So it's revolution even against revolution, ultimately. And he says, and that's the great mystery and the acceptance within Marxism of contradiction. So a lot of us out here who argue online or whatever, we get into discussions with family members, whoever, that are liberal or whatever, that are committed to Marxism. Now, those are low-level Marxists. They don't really understand what this is about. But they do kind of – they've unconsciously imbibed this idea that the antithesis to the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right, is itself contradictory but necessary. And so Rakovsky, that's being interrogated, says to the NKVD guy, he says, don't you understand that we couldn't have Marxism socialism without the economic misery and chaos? He says, how would people turn to Marxism if they didn't believe –